Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, University of Michigan professor Jonathan Marwill examines how the victims of the September 11th terrorist attacks are remembered. The class discussion revolves around a photograph by Associated Press photographer Richard Drew of a man falling from the North Tower of the World Trade Center on 9/11. This is an hour and 20 minutes.
Okay, let's begin. Yeah, so far, what we have been focusing on, first of all, was the film and the images in the Naudet film done by the two brothers, the French brothers, 9/11. So we've looked at, images of the buildings and noticeably images of firefighters because they were the main focus of the film. And then last week, we started talking about the 9/11 Commission report. That is, how was the event investigated? And we're going to continue on with that on Thursday of this week. What we haven't looked at and what you might think is in some ways not appropriate to look at are the dead. And the dead of this event, when you think about it, if you have thought about it very much, they're in a rather unusual position vis-a-vis the dead of other either terrorist attacks or attacks by political regimes or armies on populations. And that is, they're not visible. We have no bodies. You think about it. Almost all the bodies in New York were incinerated. They took out parts of bodies afterwards, and one or two whole bodies they found, believe it or not. There are no bodies at Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And I have not seen pictures of the bodies injured as well as dead of the Pentagon, though I'm sure there are some pictures out there somewhere. But in New York, it's a grave site. Ground Zero is a grave site without any bodies. And what's so interesting is they're unseen. The most obvious example of a dead person is this man, as yet not certainly identified, possibly identified, not certainly. He is on his way to death, as were some 200 to 300 more people. No one knows how many people jumped from the Twin Towers. Most of them, by the way, from the North Tower, hit first, smoking while the South Tower was then struck and went down first. Okay, most of the jumpers were from the North Tower. And as I say, nobody knows exactly, estimates 200 to 300, but that represents roughly 10% of the people killed in the World Trade Center who chose to jump rather than suffocate, be burned to death, whatever. Perhaps some accidentally fell or somehow fell, they were somehow nudged, they didn't intend to jump. But most of the people, it seems, who were seen by onlookers, people were there in the streets below, saw a lot of these people, it seemed that they jumped, that they made a deliberate. And in some cases, we know that people jumped together holding hands. These are not people being pushed. They decided to jump. And Lord knows one can understand why. The death by suffocation or by fire, noticeably by fire, is terrible kind of death. Now, today, you were to have read the article by Tom Juneau, published in Esquire, 2003, about this particular photograph, which is a set of photographs, the man falling not all the way down, but the photographer, Richard Drew, snapped a bunch of pictures, and so he's in various positions. Juneau wrote this piece about this particular image, and tried through investigation to identify who this man was. Very difficult to do when you think about it. In the piece, you may recall, he uses the phrase that this photo and others like it were iconic but not permissible. Now, this photo appeared on, I think, page 7 of the New York Times on September 12th. I remember seeing it. In fact, I have it in my office. I have that complete issue of September 12th, long before I knew I was going to teach a course like this. It never appeared again. It never appeared in the New, well, I should say it never. It appeared again in the New York Times Book Review in 2007. But it was also published in other papers. It was seen on CBS and then immediately taken off the airwaves in the United States, did not appear in magazines. There was a kind of voluntary censorship, voluntary decision. It should not be seen. If you had picked up a European magazine or a newspaper in the days following September 11th, let alone the weeks, you would have seen this picture or others like it. The Europeans did not have any trouble, or were not troubled, I should say, at least publications, were not troubled printing this and other pictures. So I guess a good place to start with this situation or this issue of the dead is to look at this image and say or ask, what is impermissible? At the same time, if it's iconic, is there not a kind of contradiction that something that would be iconic, that would have the value of an icon, would be an icon not to be seen? Now, that's more than one question. Let's start with perhaps the more immediate of the two. What's impermissible? Why should this not be allowed to be seen? You might want to think, by the way, or recall, remember what Jules Naudet says when he's going into the tower with the firemen in the North Tower, and he decides not to photograph a body at the kind of the doorway to the tower. This should not be seen, he says in the film. Maybe that would give you a handle. But what do you just instinctively think is the problem with this being sort of a forbidden image, as if it were, you know, some sexual image that people are not allowed to see, you know, one time? Yeah.
Well, in the article, it kind of talks about, in my reaction as well, is that that person has a family, and they would be severely hurt by seeing that if they recognized their family member, husband, father.
If that person had a family. Remember, we don't know for sure who he is. It's a male, undoubtedly. That seems to be certain. But even the article goes from one possibility to another possibility, but is not even sure of that. This could have been a bachelor. Okay. Do you think it's, but even if you assume that you know who it is, okay, should that have made it impermissible to be identified, since the family and friends of the family and other family members know that person died that day? So would that make a difference, even? Yeah.
I think there's kind of a difference in the way that people perceive when someone dies by, like, somewhat like something that they can't help, whereas if they choose to commit suicide, even though it may have been so bad that they knew they weren't going to live, I still think like a family member would have, or anyone who knew them would have, I don't know, had a hard time coping with the fact that like this, they died by jumping out of the building rather than.
Do you recall what the daughter of the first suspected, of the first person who was suspected to be this man, what the daughter said when she was interviewed by the journalist? It's quoted in the article.
I don't remember the exact words, but it was something along the lines of, like, thank goodness he's not going to hell or something.
Not quite, not quite.
Because I thought that they were like, it's a sin to try to...
In the Catholic religion, suicide is a sin, okay? That is, you know, you might wind up where you don't want to be. It's certainly true. Do you recall the words?
Yes, she said, that piece of shit is not my father.
Yeah, yeah. And the mother doesn't want to think so either, though she's not as strikingly eloquent as her daughter about the matter. And clearly, or seemingly clearly, it's not that they have a problem with the man's death because they know he's probably dead, but that they don't want to believe that he would have committed suicide. That's what makes him that piece of shit, as the article says. We don't have to use the word again, but the point is, it's not the death itself. And are we... I mean, the point you raise, which I think is quite a fair point, that let's say he could be definitively identified. You know, if you were a family member of that person, would you really want to see that? Well, no, you probably would not. But we don't seem in America to have a problem with seeing dead bodies from wars or crimes or traffic accidents or fires. What do you think there's, let me put it this way. What's the difference between a man actually not yet dead, he will be very soon, what's the difference between someone dead from September 11th as opposed to seeing a person dead from any number of other causes in this country that we seem not to have a problem with? And certainly, of course, movies show terrible images of the dead all the time. But let's not even talk about fictive media. Just talk about, you know, real life. We are almost bombarded with images of the dead and badly injured. I mean, we're warned. If, you know, sometimes TV programs will say, you know, disturbing images. Don't, you know, if you don't want to be disturbed, don't watch the program. But they show them. Yeah.
I think when you're talking about war or an accident, the dead body almost, that was what happened and there wasn't another choice, right? When you go to war, you're expected, not expected, but you take that risk because you're going to get shot, there's going to be a dead body. And these are normal everyday citizens who had no choice except to jump unless they want to suffocate to death. So in a way, we didn't, with these people, if you're looking as a family, you don't expect them to be jumping from a building, whereas if you go to war, you almost expect that phone call one day.
Fair enough. Would that argument then, so to speak, include why Jules Naudet does not want to photograph that person when he goes to the North Tower? Person's already dead, probably not identifiable easily, but he doesn't want to do that. Go ahead.
Well, we talked about with the Naudet brothers how he wasn't the normal photographer. It struck him as something, he's almost like an everyday citizen seeing a dead body that someone just died. Whereas we talked about if his brother was there, he was a photographer and he probably, we can't say for sure, but he would have been more inclined.
He probably would
have. As a photojournalist or as a cameraman to see that and to film it.
Then the question is, do you think they would have included it in the film? Let's say he had shot it. Remember, they shot 175 hours of footage through the training of the firemen and the fire and the buildings themselves. The question is, would they have included that image even if Gideon had shot it and when Jules did not, would they have included it in the film? Or do you think there's something about the dead of September 11th that separates them out from other dead? Sir?
Well, I don't think there's necessarily a difference between the dead of September 11th. For example, we were able to see the image of Father Judge, who in fact died on September 11th. But I think that there's something intimately personal about seeing someone in the act of dying as opposed to being dead already. To see the life in them being taken as opposed to like their in-person or inanimate body itself. There's something, you know, we can relate to them. There's more immediate empathy in seeing someone alive one moment and then dead the next. I think that's why the image of the falling man is so taboo, because it's the immediacy of his incoming death that we find so troubling, as opposed to, you know, the image of someone who's dead already.
Do you think, I like the point, I think we would all agree that's a good distinction to make. Do you think we would have trouble, because I've certainly seen such pictures, seeing someone jumping from the San Francisco Bay Bridge, Golden Gate Bridge? Because I've certainly seen photographs of people jumping. Is that different?
I think that's different in a number of ways. One being that it's not as inherently violent. The image of them, for example, perhaps crashing into the water would be less disturbing than seeing the falling man hitting the ground. And then you have the fact that he's forced to jump, whereas someone who is jumping from...
It's a voluntary act, yeah.
Voluntarily committing suicide.
Yeah.
I think there's something about the actual event of September 11th that it affected our whole country. So even if you're not a family member of someone who died in 9/11, it still affected you and like our whole nation felt more vulnerable. So I think kind of everyone is more sensitive about the issue, even if they weren't directly affected or one of their family members, just because like our whole nation was affected. So everyone is more sensitive.
We felt more vulnerable. Is somehow that sense of vulnerability we felt, which certainly was part of the experience of that day and lingered on for many days thereafter, as the country worried about, is there going to be another attack? Everybody thought there would be. I was telling another class this morning, there's something very interesting about the days following September 11th in 2001 and the days following December 7th, 1941. And that is that if you really read in the literature, go back and check it out, you realize that everybody expected that the next stop of the Japanese was California. They weren't going to stop in Hawaii. They were coming. And people were very on edge that that was not the event itself, and it was finished with Pearl Harbor. And the same thing, I think, was true. I know it was true after September 11th. The next few days, everybody said, you know, is there another city, another set of planes coming, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that sense of vulnerability. Let's hold on to that, but there were some more hands. Yeah.
I think it separates itself from other pictures that could be similar to this, like someone jumping off of a bridge, because this was a result of an act of terror as opposed to just like something everyday life, like a car accident or something like that. So this man was forced to make the decision to take his own life because of the terrorist attack.
Fair enough. I mean, that I think that says it, that it explains or offers an explanation that it was an act of terror. But I wonder if, in fact, that is really the reason why we don't want to see it. That we know that the immediate cause is the burning building, and that was created by an act of terror. I wonder if that really is what is disturbing us about it. Yeah.
I think just going along on that note, I mean, as opposed to other people, maybe even someone also jumping from a building, I think people pair that image when they see it with other images that they've seen from the day and other ideas they have from the day. I mean, so if you take that image for say, and for me personally, like when I see that, I'm picturing in my mind also the burning building and the plane hitting the building. And I think pairing that all together kind of makes it seem a lot worse maybe than the still image itself. Because if you just look at it, it's not such a, oh, I'm going to cringe at that image, like I can't look at it. But like the response it evokes from your mind.
Isn't, let me just be provocative, because I agree with you. There's some, the image is yes, you're aware that man is hurtling to his death. You can't escape that. But what drew the photographer's attention in part is the geometry. I mean, there's something aesthetically quite intriguing about the geometry of that building, the lines, the verticality of the entire image, the body going down. And by the way, that's the most commonly, that was the image chosen by the Times, where he's in vertical flow with the building, because on Drew's, you know, the other images, he's in a different position, and none of them is quite as vertical. And in fact, a couple of them, he's sort of flailing around, as you might expect. But this one, there's something, I don't want to say peaceful, that would be going too far, but he's not struggling. It's as if he dove down into the earth by his own choice, and he just happened to line up with the building. That is, there's something aesthetically right, however grotesque the overall setting is for this moment happening. Yeah, Anna.
I think the disturbing part is that he does look graceful. You mm-hmm. know, they're not going to pick a photo where he's flailing or he looks like he's in pain and struggling. They're going to pick a photo where it feels like you're watching a man take the last few moments of his life, you know, escape this burning, chaotic, smoke-filled terror above him and just take the last few moments of clean air. I think that's the most disturbing part, is because we don't think about taking that choice in our everyday lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Graceful, yes, I like that word too. And clearly the choice, I mean, it's not a choice that any of us would ever choose to be confronted with, though when you think about it, many people are. People facing their own death. Maybe one of you has a grandparent or somebody very, very ill with something or other, and the doctor says, well, I can do another operation. I'll give you 3 more weeks. And the grandparent says, uh-uh, I've had enough of it. Anybody have that experience with not wanting to? Well, I did with my mother when she was very ill. And the doctor said, oh, yeah, we can operate again. And all they could promise her was, you know, a couple more months, and not very pleasant months, so she just chose to die. So it's that the choosing of death in a certain manner, she didn't have to jump from a building, obviously, to die. The choosing of death over continually living is not altogether unusual. Yeah?
I think part of the reason that it's, like, so taboo and emotional is because, like, it's really the only picture that makes any connection with, like, how awful the people in the building were struggling. Like, you see the burning building, you see the plane crashing in, and you just think, like, this is terrible, this is, like, a horrible thing that happened. But then when you think about the fact that people made the conscious decision to jump out of a building, that, like, really brings you face to face with how much they suffered inside of that building.
Or maybe they hadn't suffered, but knew they were going to.
Yeah.
There's no evidence that this man has been on fire.
It makes them more like real people to you, to like, rather than, I don't know, it just draws a deeper connection.
Well, I think you made a very fair point. Yeah, go ahead.
And just to go along with that, it's not that's just the only picture of people inside. That's like the only picture of victims usually that you'll see at all.
Yes, I mean, we don't have very much.
This is not a guy that is surrounded by burning oil, jet fuel, and metal. This is a guy in a very clean, open, free space. There's nothing inhibiting what you see is about to happen, and you kind of have to accept it. It's the only connection you have.
Well, that leads, doesn't it, in a certain way to moving from the impermissible to the iconic. An iconic image. I mean, first, I don't even want to get to the contradiction between being iconic and impermissible. Let's just talk about, if I said to you, if I'd start out today by saying, and Juno is not the only one to have said such a thing, that this image really is iconic of September 11th, at least in New York. This is the image that really establishes what September 11th is all about. That's what an icon. This is something we really heed. Do you think that's true? Now, that's separate. They're connected finally, but that's separate from saying it's impermissible. You think if somebody wanted to say, give me an image of 9/11, you might say, well, there it is. There is the standard image. Is that iconic, though? Does that rise to a certain level of ultimately getting at the truth? Which is what icons stand for, ultimately getting at the truth of what September 11th was. And of course, that and many images like it were the images we were constantly bombarded with that day and have since ever since.
I don't think it should be the iconic image, because I think it's more of an image of destruction.
This one you're talking about.
Yeah. You see images like of buildings collapsing, even if someone purposely, obviously not in an act of terror, but if a building had to come down, you see pictures like that. But you don't see a human aspect of it. When most people look at that picture, they probably don't think about the people who are inside. Whereas when you look at the picture of the falling man, it puts a very human face on September 11th. It makes you think more of the victims, which I think is what it should be.
Well, when we see that, do you think we imagine the people inside with that image? Do you, you know, if you can, you were very young then, obviously, but when you saw all those pictures that day, you know, running on TV and the next day and the next day, did they set off your mind imagining what people inside must have felt? Or was the picture itself, the horribleness and the pictures of the buildings falling, that your imagination just stayed there with the buildings? Your imagination didn't travel inside. This picture, you can't help, let me submit, you can't help but be imagining in looking at it of what is about to happen to him. And is that what is terrible about that picture? Because you are in your mind's eye, you see it coming, what within a matter of seconds, what's going to be of him. Whereas you can never quite grasp the people inside because you can't see it. It's left only in your imagination and therefore not as powerful. Or more powerful. What do you think?
I think for me, the fact that I was in fifth grade when it happened, I'd never been to New York at that point. I'd seen pictures of the towers before, but I've never been inside. So I couldn't draw that. I mean, we thought about the people when we were sitting in class in elementary school watching it on TV, but we didn't have any idea what it looked like inside. So for us, it was that iconic image of the tower being hit, and then also later on after the fact, the lasting, I think, image was every September 11th when they anniversary, they did those beacons of light that went up in the New York skyline, and I think that was the other lasting image that I have from the tower perspective, not even talking about the Pentagon.
Well, when you were in the fifth grade, you were what, 10, 11?
10, 11,
yeah. Okay. Do you recall, was it that kind of picture, that is, towers being struck or both of them burning, that, so to speak, shocked slash impressed you, or the buildings, one and then the other, coming down?
For me, it was the second tower being, we saw the plane flying towards it, and to me, it's that image. It wasn't, I mean, the towers coming down, it was terrible, but I don't know. For me, it was the plane right before it struck.
Okay. But let's go back to the falling man or the jumper. More thoughts on what makes this iconic? What makes this so what important? First here and then over there.
I think people could argue that it's iconic because of its uniqueness. I think that most people, if you said September 11, would probably associate the other image or some sort of image of the towers being hit or on fire with that day. But because it's so unique, it kind of brings something different to the table. And it's not an image that a lot of people capture. I mean, there's a lot of views and a lot of shots of the towers getting hit and being on fire, but that's like the only picture that's been published that's of a man jumping from the building.
Before we go over here, you remind me of something, and I want to bring it up and ask you. Richard Drew, the photographer. In 1968, in June of 1968, what was it, about June 4th or 5th, he was in Los Angeles when Bobby Kennedy was giving a speech at a hotel. And that was the night that after Kennedy finished his speech and went down, he was going through the kitchen to go out to the car that was going to take him away from giving the speech. And he He probably had the Democratic nomination wrapped up at that point, okay? He was shot and killed. And Drew was one of the photographers there and took a picture, which has been seen many times, of the dead or dying Bobby Kennedy lying on the floor in the kitchen of this hotel. That was printed, has been printed many times. How do you compare that in terms of the shock? And by the way, that image is about the only image of Kennedy lying on the floor. No, there were a couple of other photographers there. They might have taken a very similar image, but no one got it in the act of shooting per se, as I recall. But it's the image on the floor of the dead or near dead Kennedy. Is that an impermissible image to be revealed constantly?
I don't know, I guess, but I think that because of the context and the response that the day itself of September 11th evokes, because I mean, just looking at that picture with no context, you don't know how high he jumped from. You don't know much about it, but knowing that it is related to that event, I think, is what makes it so much worse in the minds of a lot of people.
Interestingly, people have argued, I'm not suggesting rightly or wrongly, because historians are only prophets of the past, not of the future, but have argued that that was a significant turning point, those shots in the history of America, that if Kennedy had not been shot and the election had gone on, he would have won over Nixon, and the history of the United States would have been different. In fact, some would argue that his death at that time was more pivotal in terms of changing or not changing things than his brother's death in 1963. But you can read about that and decide for yourself. Yeah, you had something you wanted.
Yeah, so about this picture, I think, at least for me, there are a lot of parallels that you can draw from this man falling in the Twin Towers. And I think the one that pretty much stands out in my mind that I can relive the image of was seeing the buildings actually fall, you know. And then here you can see this man sort of falling, and we can build an emotional connection to it, but, you know, I will pose a question here, and then I'll try to answer it, is if the buildings didn't fall, would this picture still be sort of iconic? Because I can draw parallels between a man falling, the falling man, and the two towers coming down, falling, and therefore making it more, that much more sort of significant, sort of in my mind, if I'm seeing this photo as being truly iconic, an event of 9/11.
Well, what I think you've raised a wonderful question. And I don't know exactly the time of this, but I think it is before the South Tower actually came down. What if they hadn't come down? Would this picture be as disturbing? Forget about the iconic part now. Would this be as disturbing to us if the buildings had not fallen? The fires had gone on. Probably a similar number of people would have been dead, because I pointed out to you, it's been pretty well established that most of the people who died in the Twin Towers were at the floor of each individual tower, where the plane struck, or above. That the overwhelming number of people below those floors got out under their own steam, walked out, so to speak. So, you know, what's the impact if the towers don't fall? I think it's a wonderful way of reframing the question in terms of trying to find the sense of this picture, what it means to us and why we are so disturbed by it. Yeah.
I think if they hadn't fallen, it becomes more disturbing on a personal level, because in this image, knowing that the towers did come down, you kind of see him coming down with the towers in a mm-hmm. sense, but had they not come down, that issue of suicide and him choosing to take his own life and jumping becomes that much more real, because in that matter, he's not coming down with the building.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that? Yeah.
I think if the towers had not come down, it would be less disturbing, because with the fact that the towers did come down, he becomes all the more important. He embodies all of those dead, you know, who perished mm-hmm. in the towers that we never got to see. The author relates this image to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, to all those soldiers that we did not get to see perish, or did not know how.
And we have no real remains to speak of.
I think that brings back to the picture of Kennedy's death, in that, you know, the uniqueness of Kennedy as an individual, as a national figure, distinguishes him from the Falling Man, because the Falling Man is everyone. He is everyone who died, and the fact that he's also still alive,
you know, makes that point.
Yeah, we can put ourselves in his shoes, mm-hmm. and, you know, then therefore put ourselves in the shoes of everyone who's in the towers.
Okay. Does that, having said that, okay, is there a level at which this picture disturbs us that has less to do with, well, I don't want to say less, let's just say that disturbs us both because it's September 11th, but independent of that? Now, it's already been indicated, one student indicated that somehow, you know, this is maybe all of us at some point, but all of us wouldn't mind our pictures taken at whenever that point might be, but that this particular representation of that point of having to make a choice about life or death is a point at which we're very uncomfortable in our own skins with this phenomenon. That is, that this picture has, this is a, let me try to put this in a clearer way, that there is something threatening about this photo to us. And we may not even be able to articulate what it is, but it's disturbing us is because in some way or ways it threatened us. Yeah.
I think, like, adding to that, like, such a personal decision that he made, I mean, that I feel like we can understand, but that it was taken, like, that people photographed it, that it became the image, like, he didn't have a choice in that matter. He didn't, you know, he couldn't have known.
Well, but he did have a choice, didn't he?
I mean, yeah.
Did he? Yeah.
I don't think he could have known any, like, that it, his death, his, like, personal choice would become such a public sign.
Yeah. Do you, since the word has been used now, and it's certainly part of the inquiry by Junod, do you think that this was suicide? Your understanding of suicide?
No, because, I mean, it's clear, I think, to everyone that there were two choices, and both of them were death. He just chose to control his own family.
Does anybody want to see that any differently? Yeah.
I think it's almost a sign of, like, the last hope. You know, if you're there and you look and you see there's fire and smoke and there's people dying around you, there's an open window, you know there are firefighters there. Like, I remember always wondering why they didn't have those giant trampolines there to try to catch people if they were falling. I think it's that, like, those last few moments, that last hope that maybe if I jump, there will be something down there to catch me.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, just going back to your question about what's so threatening about it.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is what you're looking at, but
I'm not. You know, I don't have an opinion about any of this.
The Falling Man is kind of like a business, as some sort of businessman, and the Twin Towers represented like modernity in some sense of, like, you know, advancement of Western economies and stuff, and that was crashing down, and the businessman is crashing down, so it's kind of threatening to everyone, cause so Americans in general about.
So you think, so we sort of translate this into a metaphor of this image of metaphor of the larger American destructive act that this attack represents. Okay. Any other thoughts on this? Yeah, in the back.
I think maybe this picture could be seen as threatening because in a certain way this man's perceived mindset from what you think he chose to do goes against possibly a collective anger that people have. Instead of, you know, choosing to almost be defiant and stay in the building and wait for hope, he quit. He completely resigned.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what, I mean, the image seems to show. And that might conflict with what a lot of people were feeling at the time on a national level, on a foreign policy level even. So I think that might have upset some people, perhaps.
Yeah. It's interesting that his wife, we already had the quote about the daughter, his wife, if you may recall from the article, she says, that she wants, quote, to clear my husband's name, meaning that she doesn't want it to be him, because that would mean he committed suicide, and being a good Catholic, he shouldn't do that. So she clearly interpreted it, or perhaps just thought the local priest or the church was going to interpret it as suicide. But do all of you agree with what was said over here? It's clearly not suicide. It's a choice between two deaths, and how can that be suicide? Or does anybody want to? Yes, ma'am.
I don't think it's suicide, because I think this person, that day, those people in the top levels of the tower, yeah, had their choice of life or death taken from them. They knew they were going to die, and that man chose freedom. He wanted the choice to choose how he was going to die, and maybe it is that symbol of hope that maybe he'd survive somehow, but it was like a last chance at freedom. Like, I don't want to die because terrorists hit, destroyed my building.
Yeah.
I want to die the way I choose.
You know, unfortunately, we don't know what was in his head, and we could construct, you know, any scenario for what he was thinking. He might be saved. The fireman might have some kind of super mat. Or it was just a choice between two deaths, one less hideous than the other. Or who knows? But we don't know. So all we can really deal with are the interpretive schema that people close to these people or have investigated these people, what it is they want to construe this to mean. Yeah.
The interpretive schema, I feel like this photo threatens the psychological defenses of everyone who was related to the victims in New York. They talked about it a bit in the article, how after they decided it wasn't the one man whose daughter had made that statement, they questioned whether it was someone else, and the family was like, no, it wouldn't be him because his sister was there with him and he wouldn't have left her.
Yeah.
So I think it's the way that, like, the first family didn't want to think that he had jumped partly because of suicide, but also they mentioned that he wouldn't have given up, and like that he wouldn't have jumped thinking that he like wouldn't come home to them. They thought that he would have died, like thinking of his wife and his three daughters. Yeah. And the other man like wouldn't have jumped because he wouldn't have left his sister. So I think it's just, I think it's different for how we perceive it in terms of how the family members of these victims perceive it and how they sort of, their brain made them perceive it to be able to cope with it.
Perhaps our interpretation of how he perceived it or how others are interpreting he perceived it is just an extension of how we're perceiving it too. We have to be careful of that. Yeah.
I think, as you said earlier, this is like when people saw the people jumping, that was their first indication of just like how horrible it must
have
been up there.
Yeah.
So I think people might be very uncomfortable with these images, because if this allows you to kind of like see the human side and put yourself into that position, and like if you can imagine yourself like on one of the top floors having to make that decision, like you kind of think yourself like, would I want to be photographed jumping from the building? And I think a lot of people would say no. So maybe that's where kind of some of the discussion mm-hmm. comes.
Yeah.
Just from like a technical standpoint of the definition of suicide, I think that it is, because you're choosing to take your own life, whether or not the circumstances you are in are like favorable or like whether you could keep living on. I guess this guy maybe thought that he couldn't, so
yeah,
he did
yeah.
decide to take his own life. But I think that people obviously look at it in a like, well, he kind of had that only option, so it's not as maybe shameful as jumping off of a bridge or something. He was almost forced into the situation to commit suicide, but it's not, you have to look at it in context.
I'm not Catholic, but I've thought at times I should consult with a local priest what the standard was, so to speak. This must have been discussed within Catholic circles in 2001. How are these people to be seen? Are they to be considered suicides? Because in one sense, as you're trying to argue, technically perhaps they were, but or are they to be seen as people in an impossible situation where suicide is simply not any longer a relevant category of interpretation? And perhaps any of you who are Catholic, if you there's a priest in the family, you're close to one, you might want to ask. and see what was the understanding at that time. Was there a kind of going understanding on this matter within the church? As I say, I simply do not know. You had your hand up for a long time. Go on.
The idea of suicide really comes out to me in, I think it's like page 198, and there was a sort of a quote here that says they're puzzled, they're uncertain, they're scared, but when did they know, when did the moment come that they lost hope? Maybe it came so quick. So there, like, that sends like a very strong sort of emotional statement or like a psychological statement, like, when did the people know that were jumpers know that there was absolutely no hope? That they would not be saved, even on that floor, that the towers were gonna come down. Like, at what point did they know it didn't actively choose that I'm not gonna die this way, I'm gonna die another way, you know? Like,
well, obviously, in any particular case, it's not very knowable. One book that was published, 102 Minutes, I think by Jim Dwyer, which is a reconstruction of what was going on in both towers in the period of time of the 102 minutes from the first plane hitting the first tower to that first tower coming down, and talking to lots of people who survived. There was evidently continuing and considerable effort to get people out, to help people out. People stayed to help other people out. That is the urgency of life, that hardwired drive to survive, and that's a very hardwired instinct, was operating as long as possible. And then we come to that question, well, when did so-and-so or any so-and-sos know, just in some sort of instinctive fashion, that survival wasn't in the cards and that they wanted to choose how they wanted to go? And whether it even was that rational, I don't think we're probably ever going to be able to decide. Yeah?
I think there's another way to look at this that can maybe show how it wasn't suicide, and that, like, if you're pushed off a building, like, that's not suicide. And in a sense, like, these people were pushed off the building.
Like, I think that's a perfectly good argument to make.
Like a choice where they were like, this is the end, and then jumped.
It wasn't in any human terms really a choice. I want to move on a little bit. Time is going on. I want to suggest something, another way of thinking, let me put it this way, another way of thinking about this image, and why it is disturbing, why it is impermissible, and why it's iconic at the same time. And see how you react. That this picture is more than almost any other kind of image from September 11th. Certainly anything having to do with the buildings, and we don't have much in the way of images of individuals. It registers a kind of vulnerability. Somebody mentioned this very early on in the discussion today, a profound, almost existential vulnerability that we have as humans, that we are always damping down in ourselves. But that this image so profoundly touches on what we do not like to consider, and that is a kind of existential vulnerability as human beings that we always have at any age, any time. And this picture worms its way into that sense. Any thoughts on that? I'm just throwing it out as a thought. Yes, sir.
I guess the first thing that strikes me always about this is, and what will make you feel vulnerable, or if you're anything like me, is that it doesn't matter if 3,000 people were in the tower and died, well, they died in the tower, and the planes and every other situation that happened that day. At what it came down to was every person had to make that choice or go that way, whether they made that choice or not, alone.
But, good point. But, let us say that somehow or another, just imagine this, that the photographer shot not the one man, but that there were four other people alongside him. independent, not holding hands. We do know some people held hands because people actually saw it and reported it. But there were four other people. Do you think the impact of this picture on you would be the same if you saw four random people as distinguished from one? And if you think there is a difference between four and one, what do you think it is? And does it have anything to do with the point I just made? Yeah.
Person, there's an intimacy to the photo.
Yes, yes.
Like delving into his life and this moment that he's experiencing where he knows he's going to die. And you as a viewer of the photo know that he's going to die also. And it's
and you know as a viewer you're going to die too.
Yeah.
He is us. Four is not us. One is us. Did you want to add to that?
I was just going to say, yeah, if there were four people there, you'd say, well, you know, at least they kind of made the decision together, like they knew that what was going to happen. But he just seemed so alone in his last couple seconds of life. And that I think that's what kind of makes it a little more intense.
There's the famous statement, we live together and everybody dies alone. However you die, you always, your death is alone, even if there are people around. And does this picture in that sense work to that understanding? And is it what is so disturbing that it almost isn't September 11th? It's just our situation, the human situation, the mortal situation. Something to think about. I wanted to turn, but not turn entirely away from this, to the other piece that I had you read for today. The excerpt, very small excerpt, from this volume called Portraits, which was published in 2002 and is a compilation of the some 1,900, I guess you call them portraits. You might also call them obituaries, but the Times didn't like that. The New York Times, starting in the fall, as you read in the introduction, starting in the fall of 2001, after September 11th, decided to investigate, inquire into who all these people were that died in the Twin Towers, or as many as possible. And finally, over 130 reporters worked on this. Reporters from every possible field in the Times spent some time making phone calls, looking up public records, whatever else they could find, to come up with a short statement. These range from 5 to 10 sentences. None of them are very long. I've looked through the whole book, and I just Xeroxed a couple of pages out. I want to say totally randomly, but not quite randomly. And in the foreword, they use the statement. They say that these are not really typical obituaries, and that there is something consoling about these statements. And at another point, these people, the statements made about them, suggest, quote, the subtle nobility of everyday existence. And so with that sort of the lead-in, let me turn and read to you, for those who didn't bring your thing today, I want to read the one that determined which pages I would choose to show you. I said more or less randomly, not entirely randomly. And this is the one on Josh Rosenthal, a man and a sister grow up. And of course, like the others, it's short. Last Sunday night, Josh Rosenthal went out for dinner with his sister Helen and her family to celebrate the coming of fall and the fact that they were all together again after being apart over the summer. He had just picked up Catcher in the Rye, she said, and he was just adorable about the relationship between Holden and his sister. A portfolio, that's end of quote, a portfolio manager at Fiduciary Trust, Mr. Rosenthal most liked to, quote, play with his nieces, but of course I would say that, Ms. Rosenthal said, that's his sister. He would tease them mercilessly, just like he would tease me when I was a little girl. He would also bring them gifts from his many travels, like a stamp with their names in Japanese or beautiful Chinese robes. Ms. Rosenthal, the sister, who described her only sibling as her best friend, said that the two had been especially close since a two-month trip they took together through Southeast Asia about 15 years ago, where they discovered each other as adults. "He wasn't teasing me anymore," she said. End of. Now, is that an obituary? Clearly not, right? You don't know who this guy is, except he's a portfolio manager and he's got a sister who loved him. What, and they're all like this in one form or another, the half dozen others that you read. Just, they each have another different spin, but they're all like this. And as I say in the introduction, they're referred to as being consoling. What do you think that word means, and how does it apply to these portraits of the dead? Now, we've been talking about the dead in one context today. I'm now shifting your attention to how the dead are going to be remembered, at least in this first, you know, kind of exposure of them to memory in the form of these portraits. Yeah.
I think this one in particular, it's like, it's more focused on the sister and like her emotions towards Josh rather than him as a person. And it's almost as though she's like remembering him in a way that she can like let go of him and emotionally cope with what had happened to him.
Oh, that's very well said. Yeah. So what happens to Josh in this, therefore? What's the fallout to Josh if this is really about his sister?
I guess he becomes remembered as his sister remembers him.
Okay. Okay.
It's not. Yeah, it's just not really about like him as a person.
Well, I don't know how far we want to go with that. I mean, there is, you do get a sense of him, even though you might get a sense of the sister's affect more. Was there a hand over here? Yeah.
I think building on what she said, it's as his sister remembered him, but it's not. These portraits aren't painted for me to remember as a victim of September 11th. You don't want to think of him as someone who died on that day. A lot of these portraits are thinking about the person as they were, kind of almost like an obituary, except not talking about they were in the Twin Tower, they were in the plane, things
well,
like that.
Well, the book, you know, everybody there is right. Was there. Yeah.
Was there, but I think if you just look at it, right, because if you're looking at one of them and just with no context, it's not talking about, oh, they were a victim, but it was talking about their life, and I don't picture it when I was reading them. I don't connect it. Wow, what a great life. Too bad they died in the Twin Tower. I think of it as more of a celebration or of their personality. And I don't think it's nice that they don't talk about how they died in an act of terror.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I just think reading through this that it did a really great job of showing the human value that we lost that day. It wasn't just a number. It wasn't just an attack on these buildings falling down. It wasn't an attack on our economy, on our system. It was more about the people in the building and what they represented. They were just average people. And to go and get this little snippet of their lives and bring it out, I think what is a much better way to remember them. Like she said, removing the stigma of this person died on September 11th, kind of it doesn't give good credence to what they really stood for. And it's not the best way, I think, to remember them. And I think
Do you ever read obituaries?
I have a few in the past few years
here. Yeah. How would you distinguish then between the kind of obituaries you've read and this one? I mean, I take your point about, but I'm just curious then, what's the difference between this in the way you would articulate it and the standard obituary?
I think the standard obituary is just much more broad. It starts at, they usually start at the beginning and go through different phases in a person's life. And
well, the short obituary, right. Not the long one for right. Presidents, the short one for the, you know, the just, grocer down
yeah.
The street.
A few paragraphs or something. I think yeah. What these sought to do is focus on one moment and just bring that one moment and embody each person in that one moment. And I think that it shows how each story, kind of, that person's going to be remembered by that moment.
And what kind, I think you're absolutely right that that's what they do. What kind of moment is it that is consistent in all of these? Can you tease out what kind of moment the editors were looking for in these pieces? Because obviously the reporters investigated, They wrote up, they gave their write-up to the editor, and the editor said, yeah, that's great. Or he said, or she said, no, go back and let's reframe that differently. What is it that each of these is consistently trying to do, even though they're very different lives, people from different, you know, backgrounds, different occupations? You're left, I think, with something very important that is perhaps suggested in that statement where I just read it, the nobility of daily existence. What is it that you are left with, first and second? Yeah.
I think it's not so much a defining moment in their life as much as how their families and friends would remember them, or just one single moment that someone would find memorable. It might not.
What would make it memorable? What gave it memorability, if you will?
I think in this one, it's kind of just remembering a personal moment with their sibling that kind of maybe when they grew up or when they moved on or when they just learned something about the other person. I know the one prior to that, you know, when mm-hmm. the little girl said, oh, he's a keeper.
Yes.
You know, it might not be the defining moment of the relationship as a whole, but it's something that the family is going to hold on to forever.
Did you believe that the little girl actually used that expression?
They were fishing, so I think I'd believe it.
Okay. I've got a bridge in Brooklyn for you, though. Here you go.
So, yeah, going on sort of similar to his point, I think they try to portray the victim's sort of, like, voice, you know, character. They use dialogue.
Sure enough, yeah.
They, you know, there's a certain, like, quote here with Richard's one. He had a devilish grin on his face because he knew I was scared. She said, you know, it was more bringing more of a sort of a personal feel into their lives, like a little segment, you know. It wasn't so much as giving them sort of descriptions on how he was, but more like bringing in dialogue between the family members and saying, like, you know, here's how we see him and view him. And I think that was a unique way of writing about each of the victims here. So,
any other thoughts on a common denominator in these things?
I would consider love to be the common element in the
description.
They mention acts of kindness, expressions of love.
Yeah.
And you see that every story is ultimately positive, whether it's hosting barbecues for your neighborhood, getting married, moving to New York to live with a loved one. Every story is about the love that these individuals who died had for those around them.
I think that's a very good point. And would you add the word value to that? That each of these was a person of value, if only to other people. They weren't necessarily valuable to the nation.
But it went out of the way to show the connections that these people had to those around them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Other, yeah.
I like that they show the normalcy of their lives.
Yes, the everyday existence, so to speak.
Just
yes.
Every day. So they went on a fishing trip over the weekend. He was mm-hmm. out to dinner with a family. These are just normal things that happen every
single day. The nobility of everyday existence.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think, and it's well done. I mean, I've read many more than this one. Yeah.
I think, in a sense, by talking about so many people that these people touched in their lives or that they had an effect on, I think it kind of makes it seem like there was almost more victims than just the number of deaths. I mean, the more people were affected by this and victimized by this event than just, like, oh, a number of 3,000. I mean, these people's death also had an effect on so many people down the line, and it was felt more than just by, like, 2,000, 3,000 deaths.
Would that, though, have been achieved if they had just published the kind of straightforward obituary? So, for example, let's take Rosenthal. Josh Rosenthal was, what, 41, 42. He had graduated from the University of Michigan in 1979. He went to New York. He got into what he got into. And he left a loving sister, Helen. Okay, your standard obituary, because he hadn't done anything famous. He was just a businessman. Would that not have achieved the same thing as you're trying to say?
To some people, maybe. I think I think that just kind of makes it seem just so standard, and it's just like, okay, here it is. This is what needs to be written. This is the.
How many of those would you have wanted to read?
Probably none. And this kind of makes it so personal. It makes you feel for those actual connections that they had. Not just. I mean, there are a lot of people that maybe aren't so close with a family member or this or that. Or I mean, it makes it see the positive light in all of it, and like how much of an effect they actually had on these people. that were part of their lives.
Okay. Yeah.
I think that also because there were so many people that died that day, in the same way, there needed to be some way to write these obituaries or pieces about them that would make them stand out and not just make them like one of the masses that died in September 11th. So I think that's why they approached it in such a non-typical obituary way.
Each of these individuals is given a real identity, not an identity of statistics when they were born, where they went to school kind of thing, but an identity as a kind of human being. And when you think about that word identity, and then you come back to this and that, and the question is the loss of identity in the actual destruction of the Twin Towers, the fact that nothing virtually was recovered. It is a death site without bodies. Okay. And what does it mean that in the aftermath, there is this quest, if you will, a desire to give these people identity, just as the reporter for this. So what is so important, it seems, is that we identify this man. Was it Jonathan Briley, okay, the second one who seems to be the man, or the first guy, Noberto? But is that important? Is identifying him by name as important as knowing him as an anonymous jumper faced with no alternative? Is that, which is the more important thing to know about this figure? Who he was or what he faced? Is his actual identity as a human being significant to anybody else but his family? But is so to speak, the identification of him as a victim precisely like virtually all the others with no chance, is that what should matter? Heavy question. Anybody want to lighten it up in some way and give a thought to this? Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that's a really tough question to sort of answer. I think from a societal viewpoint and in the context of the event, then his identity is actually what we can see here, this unknown man jumping from a building, and what we can put in the context of 9/11. I think what we want to strive for is to actually see him as a person without the context of 9/11. I think that's what we all want to sort of eventually strive for, is to see this man without him being sort of this free-falling like jumper out of a building. You know, so I don't know, like when I first saw the picture, my mind immediately went to, I didn't see him as, you know, whether he had background or family, who his name was, or his profession. I just saw him as this sort of iconic photo of a man jumping out of a building and what he had to face. But eventually I want to get to a point where I can see him not as this jumper, but as someone else, like someone like Jonathan Rosenblum in this piece.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of it has to do with all these bodies were just jumbled under this massive heap of debris, and a lot of the bodies were never even found. So the families were kind of looking for something concrete to hold on to for that person, and other people, they were faceless bodies, and then the portraits kind of give them that something to identify, you know, and relate to, like the loss of life that happened.
Do you think as I say in the foreword, these portraits are, and presumably intended to be, consoling, okay? And I take it from the things that have been said thus far that most of you would agree with that. Reading these is not difficult, that there is something humanly, you know, attractive about each of these, such, and that, yes, you know they're dead, but the way in which they're described, they're living on the page for you. But does that, you think, and I'm only posing this, I'm not in any way, you know, suggesting I think so and I want to see if you think so, I'm only posing this, do you think in some way that that is a problem for coming to terms with what happened on September 11th? That we have managed to turn all the victims into really nice people. You know, each having their own nobility as a human being. And that by doing that, we may have been, what? Trying to distance ourselves from the actual horror of that day. Trying to make it a little less difficult to accept actually what happened, what it means to have happened, even why it happened. That we are sheltering ourselves. One, two.
I'm not sure. I know you might not be going after anything specific. But
I'm not going after anything. I'm just asking a question.
The way I see it is when we look at this, it's more disturbing because we don't know who that is. And as the end of the article says, the fact that we have known who the falling man is all along, that that could be any one of us or could be any person. But when you look at these portraits and we make these into real people, it's somewhat comforting in the fact that, oh, that's not me. Like, mm-hmm. I know that's not mm-hmm. me. I know that's mm-hmm. oh, I know that's not somebody that I know. It's not, I'm not dead. Somebody that I know isn't dead. This is somebody completely different. I've never heard of them or known them. But that guy, that could be anybody, and that's the scariest part about it.
Well, but keep in mind, when I raise that, and I'll let you speak in a second, when I raise this question about sheltering ourselves, remember, only seen once. We weren't allowed. We didn't want to. Because the reason why the magazines, the newspapers, and the TV stations took it off is because they got flooded by phone calls. Don't show that. You shouldn't show that. That's too terrible to show. You know, it wasn't some boss who just decided, oh, I don't like that picture, let's not use it again. It was public pressure not to show, and they have not ever since, really. I said 2007, the Times used it in a book review. But it's still something that's sort of in the forbidden zone. And so is trying to console us with the obituaries and trying to mask us from the horror of really the choices to be made that day, do those two things, those two efforts, so to speak, consolidate into a way in which at some level we don't want to witness September 11 in its full horror? That's the question I'm trying to raise. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, while they're comforting, I think that it makes you witness September 11th in a way that you never did before.
Okay, good.
So
let's hear.
Who wants to read about someone who's 28 years old, a week away from his wedding, whose fiance worked with him and could have been there that day, and is leaving behind not only her, but, like, a five-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Like, the idea of people dying on September 11th is tragic, undoubtedly. But when you put it on such an individual level, like, each loss, to me at least, feels more of, like, it has so much more impact when you realize, like, who else was affected by it. And like he had mentioned previously, it's not just about the 3,000 victims who passed away, but everyone who, you know, was significantly affected by their loss as well.
Okay, we have only a couple of minutes, and I wanted to fill you in on a rather intriguing aspect of this Rosenthal. Does anybody know who he was, aside from what you read there? Okay, I didn't think you would. He was a graduate of the University of Michigan. His mother, Marilyn Rosenthal, taught at Dearborn. And After his death, his mother, who was a medical sociologist, she wrote a lot. She was not a physician herself, but she taught at Dearborn in the sociology department, and I think she also had an appointment here in the medical school. She decided that she was going to put aside her actual academic field, and she spent the next 5 years of her life writing a book, researching and writing a book on the pilot of the plane that smashed into the South Tower where he was. And she went to the Middle East to interview his mother, okay, and family for this book. But she died in the summer of 2007 before she finished it, because I had gotten her to agree to come in and talk to the class the first time I taught it, which was in the fall of 2007. She was going to come in and talk about what it meant, the mother of a victim trying to talk to the family of the perpetrator, or one of the perpetrators. And what did she not simply have to overcome in dealing with these people, but overcome in her own self, in her own psyche, to pursue this as an effort. And the book was not finished, and I don't know that it's going to be finished, but she was not responsible in the sense of funding, but there is now every fall, in fact, it was just, I think, about 10 days ago, there is a Josh Rosenthal lecture here at the university named after him. And if you go down to Gallup Park on the river, there's a lovely wooden bench dedicated to him that was funded by friends of the family. And he is the most famous victim of 9/11 with an association with the university. But if you go to Alumni Hall, which, you know, is just, you know, go up the Diag and turn right, there is a plaque on the wall of the, I think it's 11 or 12 University of Michigan alumni who were killed on September 11th in alphabetical order, and I think the year of the class that they graduated in. So Michigan has a certain attachment, but the Rosenthal is the only one of them that has sort of emerged, his name, you know, connected with events here at the university. So I think that will do it for the day. I thank you very much. This was good, good. I know it's a little troubling to talk about death and these matters, but I think it is something that deserves some discussion. Thanks.
Next week on Lectures in History, University of Missouri professor John Bullion discusses the Stamp Act of 1765, which required that some printed material in the American colonies, such as legal documents and newspapers, must be on paper produced in England and have a revenue stamp. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.